This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Yes, overall inflation is a bit lower, overall being the key word there. Well, a bit lower is important too, I guess, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, I believe, the 15th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, one tempts fate. One does when one makes an economic prediction, all the more so nowadays when things are still uncertain as they are. But we did get another inkling this morning that maybe, just maybe, inflation is easing up a tad. The producer price index for October came out this morning. What retailers have to pay for the wholesale goods and services they buy so that they can do business with us. Up just 0.2% month to month, up 8% from a year ago, the lowest year-on-year number since last July. But, just because an index, the producer price index, right? Just because that goes down overall doesn't mean every item in it is down as well. Industrial metals is the topic du jour. U.S. copper futures saw their biggest one-day percentage gain in more than a decade not too terribly long ago. Zinc, tin, aluminum, they are getting more expensive again as well. Marketplace's Andy Euler starts us off.
For a while now, there's been a term in investment circles for one particular industrial metal's ability to predict the overall health of the economy. Matthew Miller at CFRA says traders call it Dr. Copper.
Copper has been traditionally thought of as just a cyclical commodity, really diagnosing the economy, often moving before or, you know, it'll be a leading indicator.
So copper's recent price increase suggests that the global economy is headed for good times. Higher prices also suggest that the dollar may finally be weakening. Bob Iacino is co-founder of Path Trading Partners.
Typically, there's an inverse relationship between the dollar and industrial metals.
And sure enough, as metal prices have increased, the yen, pound, and euro have all rallied against the dollar. Now, on the other hand, Iacino says the surge in copper prices might signal more inflation is on the way.
We've seen about a 12% rally in the price of copper. Does that mean that PPI is likely to be stronger next month and bleed into PPI the following month? Yes, it is likely to mean that if it sustains.
And it's likely to sustain if China eases up on COVID restrictions and manages to get back into high gear. The country is the largest consumer of industrial metals in the world by a long shot. And once China is back to buying as much industrial metal as it did before the pandemic, Chris Bataille at Columbia University says don't expect prices to come back down.
It's a bit of a fixed supply. Like, we're stuck with the supplies we have today. There's a very strong signal out there right now to increase that supply for a lot of these critical minerals.
But he says it's going to be at least a few years before any new mines come online. And that's if the investment happens immediately. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you take your midterm elections, you take your war in Ukraine, you try to make the algorithms care, and they don't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last fall, I talked to an entrepreneur named Lindsay McCormick. She had started her company, Bite, it's called, 5 years ago, after she'd gone looking for a sustainable alternative to those travel-sized toothpaste tubes, and finding none, wound up developing a chewable toothpaste tablet herself.
I took online chemistry classes, talked to dentists, dental hygienists, and then started pressing them out in my living room on this machine that I have behind me, actually.
We did that interview on Zoom because pandemic, right? And it came just as she was launching a new product, a $16 plastics-free deodorant packaged in a $12 metal case sold entirely through Bite's website with subscription refills. Now, though, a year later, she is working on something different.
Hey, how are you?
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for coming.
You bet. Absolutely happy to.
I went down to meet her the other day at a WeWork in Culver City, California.
So you're going to see our office. It's a little bit
I have so many questions.
Yeah.
Up to the sixth floor through a maze of conference rooms with other companies' names on them, past a row of phone booth-like cubicles.
So this is our room.
Man, I haven't been in a WeWork in forever.
Yeah.
Wow, look at that. All right, so look, so this is so interesting.
This is
an operation.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Three of Lindsay's employees and a whole lot of cardboard boxes were crowded into a maybe 10 by 20 foot conference room.
So when we were first chatting, we were actually making that product that's right here, which is our deodorant.
Yeah,
in the aluminum case. Exactly. I've used that. So sorry, that's my personal one right there.
I wasn't actually going to open it up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a bite, you can have personal.
Ew.
Anyway, Lindsay and her team were there that day to prepare something like 300 units of that deodorant for retail shelves, as in actual physical retail stores.
That's been a huge change for us in terms of storytelling, everything from packaging to, I mean, it essentially changes the DNA of your business.
So let's talk about, first of all, why did you have to make that change? Right? Because as I understand it, you were doing pretty well in your direct-to-consumer, e-commerce, you know, whatever.
Yeah, so we've been super fortunate. We are still doing very well. We're subscription-based, and we have a ton of organic word of mouth. But as a D2C brand, obviously there's been changes in the landscape. If you talk to anybody with online businesses, less people are shopping online right now than they were during COVID. And also there's been substantial changes when it comes to being able to target your customers. So a lot of brands were using like Facebook, Meta, Instagram to target their customers. The new privacy things that were put in place with iOS 14.
With Apple, right?
Yeah, huge. Like, great for consumers, great for us, our privacy. Really tough for business, right? Like,
explain that a little bit.
So before iOS 14, it was kind of like you put $5 in the Facebook machine, you get $10 out, because you were able to target customers, whether your product was really great or not, right? So that's something that, being a small brand, was great because we were able to grow really fast, but also really scary, because if brands had more money than us, they could just put more money into Facebook ads and kick our butt, right? But now, really, it's brand, it's product, it's team that's going to win. And it's harder. It's way harder. We don't have the Facebook machine anymore. But we're able to grow by word of mouth, working with influencers, going into retail, getting really scrappy and kind of doing other things that other brands don't.
You say the Facebook machine, but what you really mean is Apple has changed its privacy policies, and that's costing you more money to acquire a new customer.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. And not just us, everybody in the space.
That change in the Facebook machine, Apple's privacy policy, is one reason that Bite's making inroads into physical retail these days. It's just in a couple of specialty stores so far, but shooting for bigger retailers next year.
So what does it take for you to go from direct to consumer to now you're trying to get on retail stores? What's like the big paradigm shift?
So the first thing is, which is the most important thing to us, is customer education, right? So when you're on our website, someone goes to our website and we're able to tell you a story. We can tell you why our products are better for the planet, better for your body, justify our price point. We have all of this information that we can do. When we're on a store shelf, you know, our competition is right next to us.
Yeah.
And you have about 2 seconds to make an impact on someone.
I bet you don't have that much, because I go straight to the Sensodyne or the Crest or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we need to really stand out.
So it's all about the package, right? Kind of has to be. If I'm walking down the toothpaste aisle, you got to grab me.
Yeah.
Okay, so grab me.
You want to
say,
okay, yeah. so let me show you.
So wait, so we should say here, there's cardboard boxes everywhere.
Yeah.
So clearly you're doing stuff. You got people boxing stuff up. How are you?
Right. Neil.
Good to see you, Neil. How are you? We'll talk to you in a minute.
Yeah.
Make the sale. I mean, tell me how you're going
to
do this.
What we did, one of the things that we really wanted to make sure does great in retail, this is our deodorant. So the way that we did this, when you're a customer right now with Bite and you purchase on our website, this is the box it comes in. It's the most eco-friendly thing that we could find. It's beautiful, it's sleek, but it's just plain
and it's
white.
So boring. It's plain white with one word on it that says Bite, and that's
exactly.
it.
Exactly, because this customer is already totally educated. They know what this product is. They ordered it online.
Right.
They know what they're getting.
Right.
So when we wanted to go retail, we had to make sure, how do we grab their attention? So look in the deodorant aisle. There's a bunch of really tacky colors. They're super bright. They're trying to get your attention. So we went, I mean, Heather can tell you more, but we chose these colors, which are more on trend and also way more unique.
So we should say there's an orange, there's a greenish sort of earth tone-y, and then there's like a purpley thing, right?
Yeah.
Same basic box,
right.
Just different colors. Let me ask you this, because this would drive me out of my mind.
Yeah.
How many meetings did you have about the color palette, Heather?
Not a lot, surprisingly.
Oh, come on.
I'm serious. I mean, we went through a handful of iterations with this. Like, we went to the stores to see what color all of the unit cartons
were. So you walked the aisles?
We did.
Yeah.
She's right. Good.
Okay, so you get the color boxes, and then what do you do?
Right, so then our next job is to hopefully get their attention enough to pick it up, then turn it around on the back and find out what it is.
Right.
So those are the types of things that we put a lot of thought into, and this is all a work in progress. So if you want to look at this one, this is my terrible mock-up, Kai. This is about my artistic skills.
Well, except for the fact that it's like taped down there. It's oh my God.
And that package she handed me? Had a picture of Bites deodorant case kind of strapped or taped onto a box with packing tape.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. Heather will make it look great. But the idea is when we want to start selling in places that maybe don't have samples, how do we let the customer know that there is this a beautiful aluminum case right. inside this relatively expensive product?
It occurs to me that we have brought your operation here to a screeching halt, and for that I apologize. But you're actually like packaging stuff and getting it out, right?
Yeah, we are.
Okay, so give me the show and tell. Neil, what are you doing?
So we're pre-prepping some inventory here. We have some of our deodorant cases.
Yeah.
We have, as you can see, the cartons laid out here. So we're going to convert these into the cartons, put them in a little shipper box, get them shipped out.
This is going to sound terrible, but it's a tiny little business, but it's a business.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you're actually doing stuff. You're moving product in a tiny little WeWork in Culver City, California.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Thanks.
What's your biggest nightmare?
Biggest nightmare?
What keeps you up at night?
Interesting. I mean, for us, like, to be totally transparent, so we're a subscription business, right? So when we go retail, what happens? Do we cannibalize subscribers? Like, what happens when we go on Amazon? Are we going to cannibalize our D2C customers? Like, what's going to happen? So I think for us, like, I really think, and all of our numbers show, that this will be net positive for our business. But you never know 100% until you do it, right?
Yeah. Is it possible that I saw you in a television commercial, by the way?
Yeah, there's quite a few.
I think I was like in Buffalo or something, and I saw this woman doing chewable toothpaste things, and I was like, wait. Was that you?
That's me.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so my background's actually TV. So when we made that all in-house and put it on TV.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Lindsay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for coming in.
Need to remind you of what's going on in housing, do I? That the Fed and rising interest rates are doing a number on sales, down 24% year over year. That's according to the National Association of Realtors. Prices haven't really turned lower yet, overall, I mean, but some markets are seeing that happen, which honestly is bad news for cities, which typically depend on property and property-related taxes as their biggest source of revenue. Seattle, just for instance, had to redo its budget after forecasting a $30 million drop in one real estate tax line item. Marketplace's Matt Levin is on Housing for us today.
Let's start with San Francisco. For now, the city is in okay financial shape. Ted Egan is the city's chief economist.
Like a lot of places, we were hit by the pandemic, but we had a lot of support, particularly from the state and federal governments.
But that support is running out, and with home sales down 26% since last year and the office with a Golden Gate view less valuable than it used to be,
we're increasingly worried about what revenue looks like in the near future.
San Francisco does have other revenue sources that can help, sales taxes, business taxes, but that's not the case for many cities, including those that are vulnerable to a housing boom hangover. Farhad Omier at the National League of Cities points to Boise, Idaho.
They've been thriving this past couple of years because they rely on property taxes. But now they will actually feel the heat more than other governments.
And since the property tax assessment and appeals process can take a while, the shoe that is the office market is just starting to drop on local governments, says Joan Youngman at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy.
The change in work from home and work from office, what will be the long-term impact? It's not clear where things will settle, where a new normal will be.
Housing shouldn't plunge as much as it did during the Great Recession, and cities have gotten a lot more disciplined with their budgets over the last decade. But inflation is making those budgets less affordable, says Richard Auksher with the Tax Policy Center.
State and local governments don't just tax things, they pay for things. So what they need to be paying is also going up.
And it's not like you can get a Black Friday deal on teachers or cops. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this is game time for the U.S. soybean industry.
Third and long, it kind of seems. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 56 points today, almost 0.2%, closed at 33,592. The NASDAQ advanced 162 points, nearly 1.5%, finished at 11,358. The S&P 500 added 34 points, 0.9%, 39.91. Walmart up 6.5% today in its latest earnings report. The Bentonville, Arkansas-based company reported an 8.2% rise in sales. Strong performances in groceries, store brands, and seasonal items. Households increased their debt in the third quarter. That's according to the Federal Reserve. In fact, debt piled up through credit cards and mortgages and the like grew at the fastest pace in 15 years. Thank you, inflation. Oh, nothing. Just a million potential creditors in Chapter 11 proceedings. That's all. Yeah, we're talking about the crypto firm FTX. The company mentioned that number, 1 million potential creditors in a bankruptcy filing. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell 3.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Well, let's see now, shall we? There has been the Great Resignation and quiet quitting and probably some more high-volume quitting as well. As we tell you every time the JOLTS report comes out, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, people have been leaving their jobs in this economy in astonishing numbers. Well, we've gotten some insight into the why of it all from a new survey by the payroll and HR firm UKG, which is an advertiser on this program, we should tell you. Turns out, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, workers just aren't a very happy bunch right now.
Half of American workers wouldn't recommend their job or their employer to someone they care about, like their own kid. More than 4 in 10 wouldn't wish their job on their worst enemy.
Folks are really burnt out at this moment. One of the stats was 45% don't want to work anymore, period.
Chris Mullen directs the UKG Workforce Institute. He says with coworkers leaving for new jobs and careers or to spend more time with family, remaining workers often feel underappreciated and overworked.
Folks really want to have an enjoyable experience.
So how come we're not enjoying ourselves? Well, one reason may be raised expectations. Over the past 2 years, many workers got more flexibility, more accommodation from their employers, at least those who don't work in face-to-face essential service jobs. They've been able to work how, where, and sometimes even when they want, says Carl Van Horn at the Rutgers University Workforce Development Center.
Like, I want to live in Portland, but my employer's in New York City. Okay, fine. Go ahead and do that. Now, of course, employers are pushing against that expectation. And a lot of employees are saying, no, I'll find someone else that gives me that flexibility.
Another thing bumming out workers these days, says Peter Capelli at the Wharton School, knowing someone you used to work with is now doing better than you.
You're hearing these stories about employers bidding up wages elsewhere and allowing people to work remotely, and you can't do those things, and so you suddenly feel worse off.
Especially, it turns out, if you already make a good salary. Chris Mullen says the workers most dissatisfied with their jobs right now are
people who make between $100,000 and $200,000. Pay is a little bit less relevant in my manager, my company culture. Do I find meaning at work?
On the other hand, lower income workers are more focused on finding adequate pay, hours, and a safe place to work. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This is most definitely not, and that's putting it mildly, a great time for disruptions to the global food supply chain. In this country, as we told you yesterday, food prices were up 11% in October from a year ago. And it ain't just us. Two of the biggest grain producers on the planet are at war, and climate change has a little something to say about it, too. Record low water levels on the Mississippi River, whence a lot of American grain exports flow, are gumming up the food supply works as well. So Marketplace's Lily Jamali called up some people working on the river.
Alan Pace grows corn, soy, and wheat on his farm in Lacenter, Kentucky, just a few miles from where the Ohio River empties into the Mississippi. But the low water levels on the Mississippi have left him with fewer shipping options, so he's paying a lot more to send his harvest by barge.
Normally, it costs about 80 cents to get the soybeans or the corn from where I'm at to New Orleans. And this year it was costing close to between $2.50 and $2.90 for the same bushel to go down the river.
He's feeling the higher cost of transport in the other direction, too, paying more for products like fertilizer coming up the Mississippi.
Yes, it's, I think they call it farming. it's pretty tough sometimes when you're getting squeezed on both ends.
The Mississippi moves about 60% of the U.S. soy and corn bound for other parts of the world, according to the USDA. For soy alone, most U.S. exports are sent abroad between September and February, according to Mike Steenhook, executive director of the Soy Transportation Coalition.
This is game time for the U.S. soybean industry, and the fact that our inland waterway system is still not operating as normal. It's analogous to attaching a garden hose to a fire hydrant.
Most barges can easily accommodate at least 50,000 bushels.
But every time you have 1 foot less of water at your disposal, you are putting 5,000 fewer bushels of soybeans per barge, out of a concern that if you load these barges to their normal standards, you could encounter a grounding, you could scrape the bottom.
Steenhook says some sections of the Mississippi, especially south of St. Louis, have lost about 3 feet of depth in places that are normally 12 feet deep.
That means 15,000 fewer bushels of soybeans per barge, which is a significant reduction in the cargo carrying capacity of an individual barge.
And fewer barges are moving along the Mississippi because the river also isn't as wide as it normally is.
There is no quick solution to this.
That's Jason Miller, interim chairperson for the Department of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State University.
Many people would say, well, why don't we just, you know, send all the grain by train down to New Orleans? Well, there's only so much rail capacity.
He says that limited capacity can make rail transport prohibitively expensive as an alternative to shipping by barge.
So in some instances, you may be better off just storing it
And that's exactly what many farmers are choosing to do as they wait for shipping costs to fall. Jeff Worsham, a port manager in Osceola, Arkansas for Poinsett Rice and Grain, said his loading facility has a long backlog to work through.
A lot of the soybeans that should have been going down the river in October will now not be getting to New Orleans until November, December, even January. So this is going to have a long tail on it, even, you know, if it's corrected tomorrow.
He said recent rain has made things a little better, but the need for more storage is all the talk here, he says, because there's concern about how long the drought and low levels on the Mississippi will last.
I think it's going to stay in the back of everyone's mind.
At least until the drought ends, if it ends, and water levels return to something approaching normal. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which markets kind of shook off the geopolitical news of the day. Stocks we talked about already, generally up. But I'd have kind of thought oil would have reacted to the reports of Russian rockets killing two people in Poland. Very not good, I think, is the official international relations phraseology for something like that. Still, even with oil being especially geopolitically sensitive, both the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate and the global benchmark Brent North Sea Crude only up in the neighborhood of a percent or so. All right, we're going to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, just because Matt Levin was talking about housing earlier. Saw this item from Redfin, the real estate brokerage, that said your average home buyer has to make just over $107,000 a year, $107,000, to afford the $2,600 monthly mortgage payment that comes with a typical home in this economy. And here's the kicker. That $107,000 is up from $73,000 just a year ago. Higher mortgage rates, sticky home prices, lather, rinse, repeat, right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.